You're listening to Turning Hard Times into Good Times with your host, Jay Taylor. If you have a question or comment about today's show, Jay would love to hear from you at 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. You can also send an email to questionsfortaylor@gmail.com. That's questions, the number 4, taylor@gmail.com. Now, back to our program.
Welcome back to Turning Hard Times into Good Times. I'm your host, Jay Taylor, and I'm really pleased to have with me my good friend, John Rubino. And before we say hello to John, let me suggest very strongly that you visit his website. It's dollarcollapse.com, dollarcollapse.com. Thanks for joining me again, John.
Sure, Jay. Good to talk to you again.
Always good to have you with me on my show. In the first segment of today's show, I played an interview with Jeff Deist of the Mises Institute, along with Dr. Mark Thornton, who also writes and contributes to that institute. They both blamed the Federal Reserve and manipulation of interest rates for the cause, not the cure, of the boom and bust cycles. And they also opined that there's just absolutely no way of knowing exactly when a bubble will pop and collapse. I assume you're probably of the same view, given your free market inclinations.
so completely. When you hear a mainstream economist talk, it's absolutely shocking because they seem to ignore the most important part of an economy at any given time, which is its balance sheet. In other words, how much debt have we taken on and what have we used it for? In Keynesian economic thought, that is an irrelevancy. They don't pay any attention to that at all. You know, a mainstream economist probably can't tell you what debt to GDP is at any given time or whether the current number is a good number or a bad number. And meanwhile, the Austrian School of Economics focuses on the balance sheet of an economy, and because of that, they understand the business cycle. You know, when a society is borrowing just a little bit of money at a time and putting that money to productive uses, you're early in a credit cycle because debt is being used for productive purposes. Mm-hmm. Later in the cycle, when you're borrowing huge amounts of money and speculating with it and taking vacations with it and buying big houses, which is where we are now, a society is at the end of a credit cycle. So a collapse is coming. And that has happened continuously throughout human history. It's just a iron law of human nature, really. And the Austrians get it. The Keynesians don't. So you always want to listen to an Austrian economist if you want economic advice about where we are in the business cycle.
Indeed. And we know a lot of people who did very well by being on the right side of the markets during the dot-com collapse. I think of my friend David Tice, who used to be on CNBC constantly and the other major channels. Then, of course, more recently, 2008, 2009, people that were understanding that the housing market could not continue on forever as it was. And we heard Dr. Mark Thornton in the first segment of today's show talk a little bit about how one person he knew put their house on the market, and by the end of that Sunday, there were a huge number of bids, and the house ended up going for far more than what the asking price was on that very first day it was put on the market. And he said, "That's the kind of stuff that I remember took place." He says there are some indications that we're in a bubble like that; that things are just not real, but you can never know for sure when it's going to collapse. And, I think Greenspan was saying that. Well, Greenspan was actually saying, you never know when you're in a bubble. You can't know that you're in a bubble. That, I think, was not true. And I think he knew it wasn't true. But, politics being what it was. What are your thoughts on bubbles, and what kind of bubbles might we be looking at right now, John?
Well, to go just a little bit back in this conversation, Keynesians don't know that whether something is a bubble or not because they don't focus on debt. So they miss the most important data point, whereas the Austrians see bubbles forming because they're looking at the debt that's being used to create the bubbles. And when the debt reaches a certain size and a certain type, you're in a bubble and it's about to burst. Today, this bubble that we have blown up in the last 8 years since the 2008-2009 crisis is the biggest of all time, and it's the most broad-based. James Turk and I, in the book we wrote together a couple of years ago, called it the money bubble. because it's mm-hmm. basically the world's fiat currencies and all the financial instruments that are derivatives of fiat currencies, like government bonds. And that's everything. That's everywhere. You know, the whole world is in a gigantic financial bubble right now. It's not just the U.S. subprime housing market or tech stocks anymore. It's basically everything related to the world's fiat currencies, which means when it blows up, it's going to affect everybody, not just people speculating in tech stocks or asset-backed bonds. You know, it's everywhere, and it's going to affect everyone. So this is going to be bigger than anything we've ever seen. It's absolutely 100% guaranteed to burst at some point. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But we can't know whether it's this year, next year, or 2022. You know, that's unknowable, because complex systems don't move in a linear fashion where they hit a certain point and they have to change. You know, a complex system can go on for a long time until something happens to crack one part of it, and then that crack spreads to everything else. We don't know what that'll be, but we know it's coming.
Another Austrian concept is that of malinvestment. And John, I can't help but think that with the manipulation of interest rates, not allowing interest rates to find their equilibrium because the central bankers are pumping huge amounts of money into the system always to try to control interest rates, that you're not allowing price discovery of capital, essentially. You're not allowing the markets to determine what the right price of capital is. Therefore, you have money flowing into investments that make no sense, right? And so not only do you have this enormous amount of debt, as you point out, but you also have incredibly inefficient applications of what's left of capital, right?
Oh, yeah. Well, when governments respond to past credit bubbles bursting by making money artificially easy, then that sends the wrong signal to the world's entrepreneurs and governments, because they see that money is incredibly cheap by their own historical experience, which is a signal to them to borrow lots of money and then invest it. But because they're borrowing at a, you know, an artificially low rate, they tend to invest in things that may not make sense, because they're looking at the wrong cost of capital, really.
Sure.
And so you get spectacles like the Chinese government quintupling its debt in a period of like 6 years and building entire cities and airports and roads that nobody lives in or drives on or flies into and out of now. You know, so that's a classic case of malinvestment, where it's never going to generate the cash flow it needs to pay off the debt. Mm-hmm. But stuff like that is basically everywhere now, where you've got people maxing out their credit cards in order to buy big houses, thinking the house is going to go up forever. Well, probably not. And companies building factories that aren't needed. You know, we have insane amounts of capacity worldwide in cement and steel and autos, and the list goes on and on. You know, we can make way too much stuff for the amount of cash that consumers can raise by borrowing in order to buy that stuff, you know, and those things have to go bankrupt. They have to be worked off because they can't generate enough cash flow to support themselves. And again, because this is a global bubble, that malinvestment is everywhere. You can find it in the developing world. You know, Latin America has incredible amounts of malinvestment. You find it in the developed world, where the U.S. and Europe and Japan all have overcapacity in various parts of the system and grossly more debt than they should have. So once this starts to be worked off, and there's no way to know where it begins, you know, what thing blows up first that then moves into the core and infects everything else. Once it starts, it's going to be amazingly big and broad-based. You know, if the Japanese government, for instance, which is only functioning because its interest rates are zero, it doesn't have to pay any money to borrow.
Yeah.
And if it did have to pay money to borrow, its interest costs would eat up all its tax revenues. So the Japanese government could be the first to go. China has, as I said, created this incredible credit bubble that will have to burst. It always does. And then the U.S. is just a complete mess, especially if you include derivatives and unfunded liabilities of pension plans here. You know, we're basically bankrupt by mm-hmm. any reasonable standard. And Europe is a basket case, too. So yeah. Somewhere, something blows up and infects the rest of the system. We just can't know what and when, but we know it's coming.
We know it's coming, and of course, then the question is, what do we do? And of course, you and James Turk have addressed that issue in your book. But, you know, you mentioned China. China has this enormous debt issuance. You know, my good friend Chen Lin reminds me of it all the time when I suggest that maybe China was, it's building up its gold reserves like mad, and it's now seeming to want to get rid of dollars. It wants to make its own currency, its own, what I would call an illegitimate currency, just as the dollar is an illegitimate currency, of like fiat money that's created out of nothing without anything backing it. But at least China now is talking about backing its currency to an extent, if I understand correctly, with some gold. And in fact, it's my understanding that they are going to start. They have a gold exchange now, and they're going to also have an oil exchange. It will be denominated in their local currency, in fact, they are saying that they will they want to buy oil from different countries, paying with yuan backed by gold. Do you think gold can save China? Perhaps. I mean, they are, to me, I see it as sort of a geopolitical maneuver on their part. They're tired of the United States using their dollars that are creating out of nothing for military exploits around the world and knocking on their borders. And they're saying, we don't like this anymore, and we don't want your dollars, but we've got all this gold, and if people want to use our yuan, they can exchange it for gold. What are your thoughts on that development?
Well, China, by borrowing all the money that it's borrowed, is doing something very dumb and stupid, but at the same time, as you said, it's accumulating a lot of gold, which is smart. And there's no real way to know for sure which of those two turns out to be the more important policy going forward. But the fact that China, India, and Russia, between them, are buying up about all the gold that is created each year from the world's gold mines implies that they understand the monetary situation better than the West does. You know, they see the world's currencies being inflated away in order to deal with the debt that's been taken on, which means that the dollar and the euro and the yen will go down in value over time, because that's the only way to get out from under this debt. Well, what won't go down in value is gold and, to an extent, silver. Those are older currencies that can't be created in infinite quantities by governments, so they tend to hold their values when governments are screwing up their national currencies, which, you know, leads to the conclusion that you should be buying it. And China and India and Russia are doing that on a vast scale. So if China is able to, for instance, trade oil in its own currency rather than in dollars, using a gold backing of their currency to make their currency interesting to non-Chinese traders, then that's a really good thing. And it's a really dangerous thing for the dollar, because one of the reasons the dollar is the world's reserve currency is that we, years ago, cut a deal with Saudi Arabia in which we would protect them in return for them only taking dollars for gold, for oil. And that created something called the petrodollar, which is basically a currency that is linked to oil and therefore extremely valuable, because everybody needs dollars in order to buy oil. Well, you take that away, and then the world doesn't need as many dollars as it did before we took that away. So the value of the dollar would, other things being equal, go down. And that might mean that over the next few years, the dollar leads the world's fiat currencies downward, because the supply-demand imbalance is biggest for dollars. And that's not to say that the other currencies will be strong. They'll just go up versus the dollar, but they'll go down versus real stuff. And that's one of the things that makes it hard to figure out what currencies are doing, because we value them against each other. So one is strong and one is weak at any given time, but they're all really weak relative to the things you can buy with those currencies. So that will just accelerate the process if the dollar is no longer the only thing you can use to buy oil.
Yeah, and the petrodollar, Kissinger went off to Saudi Arabia, as you suggested, making this arrangement. And so they formed OPEC, and then all the OPEC countries were required to use the dollar. Of course, the dollar then was used for almost everything globally. It was and has and still is at this moment the world's reserve, number one reserve currency anyway. But obviously the Chinese are trying to to change that, but it's certainly a lot of people think that the military-industrial complex that was helped to finance, to be financed by this ability to create endless amounts of money out of thin air, was also used to enforce the dollar. Some people think the Iraq War, the disposal of Gaddafi as well, and others, and all the countries that refuse to use dollars are somehow deemed to be rogue nations. So can you imagine that? Well, anyway, another thing that's come into play here, John, that's really interesting is Bitcoin. And China apparently is very troubled by this presence of Bitcoin. Would you care to comment on that development?
Oh, yeah. The rise of cryptocurrencies in general, and Bitcoin in particular, has been fascinating over the last few years. And one of the big questions has been what governments are going to do once cryptocurrencies become a threat to these national monopoly fiat currencies. And we're seeing the outlines of that response take place lately. The IRS in the U.S., for instance, announced that they now have tracking software that can tell who is buying and selling Bitcoin and generating tax consequences because of that, because they count Bitcoin as a commodity. Which means Sure. Every time you sell it or buy it or use it to buy something, you've created a capital gain or a loss. And you got to total that up and pay taxes on it at the end of the year. Now they can tell who you are, and they're going to come after you if you don't do it. China, meanwhile, just banned initial coin offerings going forward. In other words, you can't bring out a new cryptocurrency in China and then sell it to the public and see how it trades anymore. And that's been one of the big factors in that market where, you can bring out a new cryptocurrency and sell it and make a lot of money. There's something like 900 cryptocurrencies out there now because of this. If that ban is going to hold in China and then spread to the rest of the world, then that changes the dynamic in the cryptocurrency market dramatically. And there's no end to this because to the extent that these currencies grow and become popular, they are threats to the dollar and the euro and the yuan and to those governments' power. And they won't let that happen. The governments will either try to regulate cryptocurrencies out of existence or just make them illegal or co-opt them somehow, And that all has to play out. We don't know exactly what the details will be, but we know that that's going to be a big part of the story in cryptocurrencies going forward, and it's going to add an element of uncertainty. If you don't know that your money is going to be made illegal or not going forward, then that money's a lot less valuable. So it could affect the price of cryptocurrencies dramatically, especially if the U.S. or Europe get involved in something the way China is behaving now.
Yeah, for sure. Well, John, I think you and I, we've talked about it many times. Gold is the currency. That's where you should be putting your savings now. You need to hold a certain amount of currency just to conduct your business, your daily lives, and so forth. Gold is the place to put your savings. But Michael's telling us that gold shares, but gold shares in general, as he sees them, outperforming gold. So gold, obviously more risk. It's a business you're investing in when you buy a gold mining company. But they've certainly been kind to me so far this year and to a lot of my subscribers and other people as well, especially some of the exploration companies like Novo Resources and Klondike and a few of those things. Any comments on the relative value of shares versus gold bullion?
Well, mining shares are more volatile than the underlying metal. So they'll tend to go up in good times and more than gold and down in bad times. Now, we're coming into a pretty good time for gold and silver, which means the mining stocks ought to do real well. And your listeners should know that your top pick in your newsletter, Novo Resources, has gone up almost 10 times in the past year from in U.S. dollars, 49 cents a share to $3 and something right now. So that's the kind of thing that can happen in the junior space when things really get going. You'll see these things just take off. So, I'm reading your newsletter with interest because I want to find some more Novo Resources. And I think the next few years is going to be fertile ground for that kind of thing.
Yeah, I think that there may not be too many more Novo Resources if it's as big as we think it is, but there are a lot of companies out there. Klondike is one, RN Resources another. Well, a lot of others that are in my newsletter, I think, have great upside potential. During bull markets, it's a great time to own these things. During bear markets, it's not a very good time. I suffered through it and, was wishing that I had been paying attention to Michael Oliver, Get Me Out in 2012, because we went 2012 to 2016. 3-4 years of very painful downturn. And the gold shares, you know, when you're in a bull market, the gold shares can go up by 6, 7, 8 times. The indexes go up by that much, 5, 6 times anyway. But you can lose 80% of your value in a very short period of time. And the real key, John, from what I understand, is that you need negative real rates of interest to really drive this. So as the policymakers are driving the interest rates lower, that's extremely bullish for gold. We're basically out of time. Any one last thought, perhaps?
No, I think we've covered everything really well today, Jay.
So. Thank you so much, John, for your time. Always good to hear from you, and you know, always welcome back. We'll talk to you again sometime in the near future.
Great. Thanks, Jay.
All right, folks, that's it for this week. Next week, Dan Oliver will be with me, and I think Michael Oliver, hopefully, will also join me, and Robert Carrington. He's heading up another exciting junior mining company called New Range Gold Mining. They have a project in Nevada that looks very, very exciting. So until next week, goodbye, and God's blessings to you.
Thank you again for listening to Turning Hard Times into Good Times with Jay Taylor. Please join us again next Tuesday at noon Pacific Time, 3 p.m. Eastern Time on the Voice America Business Channel.